The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is titled, Georgia Senator Michelle Au Shares What You Can Do to Help the Asian American Community. On March 16th, I spoke with the Korean Student Association at Southern Methodist University in Texas. Over Zoom, the college students asked me tough questions about racism against Asian Americans, questions I, the daughter of Taiwanese immigrants, didn't ask until my 40s. I offered what I've done as a journalist to spread awareness. I told the students they were my hope that things could change. I left the conversation feeling positive for the first time since March 2020, when Kung Flu, quote-unquote, was first used to label COVID-19. Hours later, after my husband and I tucked our daughters into bed, I read a headline that twisted my stomach. 8 people killed in Atlanta-area massage parlor shootings. 6 of the victims were Asian women. I sat in my kitchen and cried. When I watched the Atlanta police press conference the following day, rage replaced the hope I felt when I spoke to those students. Cherokee County Police Captain Jay Baker told reporters there was no reason to believe the shootings were racially motivated. Later, it was revealed Baker purchased a T-shirt with COVID-19 imported virus from China emblazoned on it. Looking at the screenshot from Baker's Facebook profile, I was alarmed by how many people liked, loved, and laughed at the photo. I feel like racism towards Asians seems more accepted than other types of racism, Georgia Senator Michelle Au tells Oprah Daily. I think about the fact that someone in a prominent public position thought it was okay to post that type of shirt on social media. In the aftermath, my non-Asian American Pacific Islander friends asked me, "What can we do to help?" I spoke with Senator Au, who represents a district that is 24% Asian American, for an answer to that question. In particular, what to do to support the Georgia AAPI community. The day before the shooting, she told her fellow senators, "All I'm asking right now, as the first East Asian state senator in Georgia, is simply to fully consider us as part of our communities. Recognize that we need help, we need protection, and we need people in power to stand up for us against hate." The AAPI Democratic Caucus introduced 3 bills to the Georgia state government in response to the shootings. 2 bills focus on community outreach. We saw that there were in-language issues with victims' families not being able to report or speak with law enforcement, Au says. Mario Gonzalez, whose wife Delana Ashley Yon was killed, was handcuffed and detained for 4 hours before he was able to confirm Yon was his wife. Gonzalez later questioned if the reason for his detainment was because he's Mexican. Au explains that both bills request translation services for 911 emergency operators and law enforcement. The third bill would require a 5-day waiting period to buy a firearm. The gunman purchased his weapon the morning of the crime, and that afternoon he killed those people. It's not an AAPI community problem, it's an American problem, Au says. According to Stop AAPI Hate, Asian American women in Georgia are 3 times more likely to experience hate incidents than men. Speaking to Au, I expressed my concerns as an Asian American woman who reads about attacks daily. How can we feel safer? I think that's a tough question for me to answer because I don't actually know what the solution is. If I did, we would be doing it, Au admits. The smallest step is to convey to people the importance of reporting because we cannot direct resources where they're needed if we don't know where the problem is or how big the problem is. You cannot fix a problem if you can't measure it first. Au acknowledges there is more awareness about the anti-Asian racist incidents than ever before. We're hoping people will take this attention and turn it into advocacy and political action because this is how things change and how things get done, she says. Here are some tips on how to support the Stop Asian Hate movement. Number 1, spread awareness. Senator Au says the best way to help is for non-AAPI allies to amplify the Stop Asian Hate movement. It seems like the only people who are talking about it are people who look like us, Au says. To do so, she suggests posting shareable infographics from the nonprofit organization Hate is a Virus. read their recommended books about the issues facing Asian Americans, such as Minor Feelings, America is in the Heart, and No No Boy, to name a few. Follow Stop AAPI Hate for events, reports, and stories, and discuss the issues with your family and friends. Number 2, volunteer your time with Asian Americans Advancing Justice Atlanta if you live in the area. Senator Al recommends this local organization, which provides financial support for the victims' families and legal assistance. Number 3, donate to charities if you have the means. Individual GoFundMe fundraisers aid families affected by the tragedy, and an Atlanta March 16th Survivors fundraiser, distributed by the National Compassion Fund, will be dispersed to the families of those killed as well. Number 4, sign the community statement from Asian Americans Advancing Justice Atlanta to join organizations and individuals who denounce anti-Asian harassment. The statement calls for allies to stand in solidarity against systematic racism and gender-based violence. Number 5, vote in local elections. Prior to the 2020 election, Georgia had only one AAPI state legislator. Now the state has 5. The amount of turnout from the AAPI population in 2020 more than doubled this past summer. When you see you are represented by people who don't share your values, vote them out, Al says. Number 6, sign up for free bystander intervention training. With increased racist attacks, the training provides effective strategies for intervening when you see anti-Asian harassment online or in person. Number 7, stand up against Asian American racism online. If you read something offensive on social media, speak up, says Ao. Our next article is titled, What are healing crystals and do they actually work? Over the past few years, New Age wellness trends like salt therapy and past life regression therapy officially re-entered the mainstream. Using crystals as a form of self-care have particularly risen in popularity, appearing all over Instagram, on the shelves of yoga studios, and perhaps even on your coworker's desk. For starters, proponents believe that crystals are conduits for the healing energy of the earth when used correctly. Crystals emit positive, uplifting, energizing, and calming vibrations that help you achieve a more peaceful mind and a revitalized physical state of being, explains Heather Askenosi, co-founder of Energy Muse, an online crystal shop. Each crystal is said to have a different effect on the mind and body. Crystals' vibrations are said to arise from the unique way their atoms and molecules move and interact, says Amy McCree, holistic health expert and author of the mood book, Crystals, Oils, and Rituals to Elevate Your Spirit. These vibrations and energies can then supposedly affect our human bodies and minds. Our bodies are dynamic, electromagnetic organisms. We have physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual energy flowing through us all the time, McCree says. Crystals are a fun and unique way to help direct and influence that energy towards greater health when used with the right intention. Although it may sound a bit bohemian, our ancestors have valued crystals for ages. Humans have used stones for healing and energetic purposes for thousands of years, explains Kavini Avila, an animal intuitive and certified practitioner in energy mastery. According to Avila, ancient Egyptians used crystals for healing and protection. Sacred Indian texts explain specific healing properties of various crystals and how to use them to treat illnesses. Chinese medicine often includes the use of crystals. And ancient Greeks and Romans used crystals for protection in battle and in medical treatment, just to name a few examples. So perhaps it's not so far-fetched that in modern days we're turning to the potential healing powers of crystals and stones. Or is it? First, what do healing crystals do? There's no scientific research that backs up the claim that crystals can be used to cure disease, said Naiva Misore, MD, a primary care physician and medical director of One Medical. Because illnesses are not caused by negative energy or wavelengths, crystals technically can't cure disease in the way that crystal proponents explain, she says. However, let's not disregard the power of crystals so fast. While there's no scientific evidence that they can fix medical conditions, they could have some mental and even physical benefits, thanks to the so-called placebo effect, Misore notes. Similar to the way we put faith in the power of prayer and other religious beliefs, placing hope in healing stones may not be so far-fetched. While it can get a bad rap, the placebo effect is real, Misor says. The benefits of the placebo effect are strongly supported by research. Plus, the power of positive thinking, whether related to possibly powerful rocks or not, has been shown to affect health outcomes in patients who are going through treatments. Plus, crystals probably aren't doing you any harm. Unless you're overspending on an expensive therapeutic treatment or only relying on crystals to boost your well-being, Misor says that adding some gems to your life can increase your positive energy and confidence, or remind you of an intention. The bottom line? Consider crystals something to add to your healing toolkit. As Suzanne Monroe, founder of the International Association of Wellness Professionals and author of the Holistic Cookbook and Lifestyle Guide, suggests. Like anything related to your health and wellness, from green juice to yoga to meditation, crystals can be an addition to your routine, but not a substitute for a doctor's orders, nor a be-all, end-all solution. Our well-being can only be summed up by numbers and data, Monroe notes. And if crystals can support us in a way that we can't see but we can feel, isn't that powerful enough? How to choose your crystals. So you're ready to dabble in the purported powers of these stones? The first step to working with crystals is to determine your most immediate health or wellness needs, like easing anxiety or increasing serenity, and choose a crystal accordingly. Crystals are used in many different ways. Some, like rose quartz, make beautiful accent pieces in your home and create a loving atmosphere. Crystals can also be worn as necklaces or other types of jewelry. And with colors ranging from green to black to pink, you're sure to find an option that matches your mood and wardrobe. Others exert their calming powers when you carry them with you, while there's a variety you'll want to hold while meditating or practicing deep breathing. Keep reading to figure out which kind of crystal would be best for you. Clear quartz. This neutral energy conductor is a great stone for beginners. It can add more energy and charge to your intentions while meditating. Black tourmaline. This protective stone purportedly helps to block negative energy from entering your space or impacting your own personal energy. Place this crystal by your front door, on your desk, or in the four corners of a room to protect your environment. Amethyst. Whether you're looking for solace from a busy day or help falling asleep, amethyst offers calming energy. Try placing it in your bedroom for relaxing vibes. Citrine. This bright, sunny stone radiates joy, happiness, and light. When you're feeling down, reach for citrine as a reminder to tap into your inner happiness. Aquamarine. These stones can help you speak your truth, especially when worn as a necklace, by amplifying the energy of your throat chakra. They can assist with creative projects, and also they're said to be a good accessory if you're having a difficult conversation. Rose quartz. Known as the stone of love, rose quartz can help open your heart up to all types of romance. Hold it over your heart to align it with the energy of love. Keep it in the bedroom for obvious reasons. Tiger eye. This stone is very grounding, which helps you be present in your physical body. It's said to help improve athletic performance. Try wearing this bracelet when you need an extra oomph to get through a tough yoga class. Try wearing this stone when you need an extra oomph to get through a tough yoga class. Moonstone. Astrologer Lisa Stardust says that moonstone harkens new beginnings by inspiring us to get in touch with our truest nature and emotions. It helps the heart and sacral chakra to be open to new opportunities and possibilities. Green calcite. Stardust calls green calcite a road opener crystal, which gives a boost of energetic fuel when we're feeling stuck. The crystal, which encourages transformation through healing, is said to ease the blockages that may be keeping us from growing. Pink opal. Are you one to get easily riled up? If so, Stardust recommends pink opal, whose properties include releasing anger and tension. You're a stone's throw away from serenity. Kyanite. Stardust says this dusky blue stone can help bolster the mind-body link. The stone is said to help foster intuition, useful for daily life or for that burgeoning tarot practice. pyrite. Per Stardust, pyrite is an all-purpose stone, bringing protection on all levels. It's especially helpful in warding off energy vampires or people who drain you. Selenite. The crystal supposedly clears out the day's accrued bad vibes and envelops you in a more peaceful flow of energy. For an instant boost, wave the selenite wand around you or around a friend who's having a hard day. Okay, you've got your precious stones. Now what? Regardless of which one you choose, make sure to charge your crystal by letting it sit in a sunny windowsill or outside in direct sunlight or moonlight for at least 4 hours, McCree says. Soaking up sunlight and moonlight helps your crystals hold more energy, she explains. Then, in the same way that you need a sense of direction in order to be most productive, so does your crystal. Giving your crystal a job allows you to set your intention for the work you'll do together. When setting your intention, try to get as specific as possible, suggests Askenosi. If you're trying to bring more energy into your life, visualize how you would feel with that added boost. If you're trying to cultivate more peace, think calming thoughts. To program your crystal, Askenosi recommends sitting quietly, holding the stones in both of your hands, and thinking about your goal. The stone then absorbs your intention and becomes activated, she says. You can then use the crystal in whatever way works for you, such as wearing it as jewelry, placing it in your desk or on a windowsill, or simply holding it in your hand every time you need to be reminded of your intention. As Askenosi notes, no matter your goals, all crystals can help you on your journey toward better well-being when used with intention. For example, perhaps your intention is to speak up for yourself more at work, or maybe you purchased a rose quartz crystal to invite romance into your life. Think of your crystal as a touchstone, both literally and figuratively, that can help you remember your purpose as you go about your daily life. Our next article is titled, Why Can't is Not in Dionne Warwick's Vocabulary. There's no other way to say it. Dionne Warwick is having a moment. Of course, those who are well aware of the 6-time Grammy winner's storied pop, soul, and R&B career, which kicked off with 1962's Don't Make Me Over, maybe scratching their heads. Warwick is a musical icon. When wasn't she having a moment? But a new wave of millennials and Gen Zers are catching on to her legacy after being introduced to @DionneWarwick, Queen of Twitter. Equipped with social media lessons from her hysterical niece, the 80-year-old mastered the art of tweeting a mix of tasteful shade, witty pop culture quips, artfully placed emojis, and sage advice. In case you need evidence, here are a few examples. @DionneWarwick. I hope that DaBaby's mother calls herself DaMama. This would be a wonderful full circle moment. @DionneWarwick. People can like things that you might not like. That's how the world works. Bye. Thanks to Warwick's interactions with her more than 500,000 followers, whom she affectionately refers to as her babies, the vocalist has managed to forge friendships with today's biggest hitmakers, or as she calls them, her babies of the industry. She now counts Taylor Swift, Cardi B, and Chance the Rapper as acquaintances after her hilarious thoughts about each became trending topics. We've become very dear friends, Warwick tells Oprah Daily about Chance. We've talked on the phone and we're doing a project together. But long before the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominee was rubbing virtual shoulders with 2021's hottest celebs, she collaborated with Elton John, Gladys Knight, and Stevie Wonder in 1985's That's What Friends Are For. She counts the likes of Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Dean Martin as mentors. As Warwick tells it, each were a part of helping her forge her identity as an artist that was within her ever since I was born, given that she was raised in a family of gospel singers. Her natural gift helped her to define the pop sound of the 1960s and beyond during 60 years in the music industry, resulting in 5 albums, 56 songs on Billboard's Top 100 chart, 12 of which were in the top 10, over 100 million records sold, and a 2019 Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award. With that track record, we wouldn't dare ask Warwick to slow down. She completed 2 Las Vegas residencies in 2019 and appeared on The Masked Singer the following year. Up next, she has a European tour scheduled, and songstress Teyana Taylor is set to play Warwick in an upcoming series about her life. Little is known about the project, so we have no premiere date or other news just yet. But while it's in its early stages, the work has started behind the scenes. We've had several conversations, Warwick tells us, about Taylor. She's done her homework. She knows more about me than I know about me. With her resilient spirit, Warwick has obtained living legend status. Here, Oprah Daily welcomes her to the Wisdom Corner to hear some of the best lessons she's learned so far before she can take them to Twitter. We have to talk about Twitter. How did you decide to become more involved? I was sitting with my nieces and nephews one afternoon, and they were laughing and giggling, and their little thumbs are going crazy on their phones. I kept saying, "Well, what's going on? Why are you guys laughing so much?" My niece, Brittany, said to me, "We're on Twitter." I said, "What's Twitter?" She explained, and I said, "Show me how to do it, because I want to know, too." I don't do it every day. That's not my thing. I do it when I feel there's a need to have something said, and I am having the best time. It's a giggle for me, based on the fact that the babies, as I call them, have gravitated to me and have been asking questions. And I've been giving them answers. I'm straightforward. I think that's what they're really enjoying, getting the real answers. And I must add that I'm learning from them as they are learning from me. There is a mutual admiration in society going on right now. Being straightforward is something many admire, particularly right now. I've always been that way. I don't find anything wrong with saying what is true or on your mind. I don't feel that I say anything or do anything that is intended to hurt anyone. I think social media has promoted that people have to be mean and evil. Finally, somebody is being tongue-in-cheek, putting a smile on their face, and able to say things that are meaningful. I take things in the way that they're said, as opposed to trying to read between the lines. I think that's the only way to be straight up and honest. You amaze people because typically in our culture, when we get older, women in particular are expected to slow down. I'm doing what I think most people would expect of me to do, and I have other interests as well. You know, I have an interior design company. My partner, Bruce Garrick, and I have been together for the past 33 years with our company, WG Design Labs. It totally relates to music for me. Design also has all the elements of music. It has color, it has ups, it has downs, it has rhythm and texture. We've been doing it without anybody else other than Bruce and our clients knowing. I think it's time for everybody to know. When it comes to your career, what keeps you motivated throughout the years? I love what I do. I love singing. I love music. I can't imagine a world without it, or the fact that people want to continue to support my career. My concerts are sold out. Tons of mail from fans comes in that I take time to answer. It's my life. At this point in time, I'm going into 60 years of being in this business, so I must happen to love it. Otherwise, I'm just crazy. Has there been a time in your life when you felt you were most resilient? To be perfectly honest with you, I feel I'm like that every single day of my life. I don't feel that there is or ever will be a time when I don't feel capable of doing anything. It doesn't fit within my psyche or the way that I was brought up. That word can't, C-A-N with an apostrophe T, does not exist within my vocabulary. I learned that in the third grade. I had a teacher I will always revere, Mrs. Daniels. I was sitting in the classroom and we were learning a lesson. I said, "I can't, I can't, I can't." She called me to the blackboard and she wanted me to write a word. And she said, "I want you to write this word, A-M-E-R. Now put a dash, put an I, put a dash. Now write C-A-N. She told me to read the last three letters. I can. She said, "Do you see a T anywhere? You are an American. There is nothing in the world that you cannot do." I never forgot that. I'm sure Mrs. Daniels is in heaven smiling now. That makes me very happy. I tell that to my children. Do not use the word can't. I won't allow it. It forms who you are. My kids have been taught, I want you to express yourselves. Just converse with each other, which is something a lot of people have lost sight of how to do. A word is such a small thing, but it has a lot of power. You bring so many people joy, but what brings you joy in your everyday life? I think seeing people smile. The best thing in the world that you can do is smile. My grandfather was a minister. He taught me something when I was 14 or 15 years old. When you look at me, he'd say, take that frown off your face. You know what that does, don't you? It gives you wrinkles. I say to people, you don't see wrinkles on my face because I know how to smile. Many want to know how to stay youthful. For you, it's that simple. Smile. It all comes from inside, and I really like me. I do. I like me a lot. I take good care of me and love smiling. That's the best thing in the world. Laughter is the best medicine anyone can give anybody. How would you define wisdom? I don't know if that's something you learn or acquire. I don't know if I really am wise or have wisdom. I just know that I'm honest. I look at things as they are, not as I want them to be. I'm as human as the next person. I've had problems and I've had the ups and downs. It's called life. I take life day to day because nothing is promised. Our next article is titled, After Learning He Was Adopted, This Man Chose to Reconnect with the Family That Gave Him Up. Until he reached elementary school, Matthew Gomez didn't know he was adopted. I grew up in a little suburban town in California. Matthew, born Frederick Allen, tells OprahMag.com, adding that childhood was great. Still, Matthew couldn't escape the feeling that he was somehow different than the other members of his family. As a kid, I felt like Casper the Friendly Ghost, remembers Matthew. When he was a young boy, Matthew's parents sat him down and explained that he had been adopted. He was shocked. It left an odd emptiness in my spirit as a kid, not knowing who this mysterious woman was that gave me up for adoption, says Matthew. His adoptive parents told him what little they knew about his birth family, that they had gone through hardships in the past, which had led to the decision to give Matthew up for adoption. As painful as it was to learn that he was adopted, Matthew's adopted mother supported him completely. I had the love, patience, and faith of my adopted mother to help me get through the hard times, he says. Matthew was 25 years old when he began looking into DNA testing, but it was nearly a decade later when he decided to delve deeper into his history. I decided to take the leap of faith, he says. I just wanted to finally meet my birth family. The first DNA test gave him names of family members, and a second helped him better understand his ethnic background. Matthew learned that he was Portuguese, Italian, and Greek, and that he shared DNA with members of the Royal House of Genoa and the House of Grimaldi. It answered a lot of health questions for me, says Matthew, but he debated reaching out to his birth family. Did he really want to see them? Would they actually want to meet him? After enduring a particularly difficult time in his life, Matthew decided it was time to make contact with his birth mother. With the help of a close friend, Matthew pulled her address from census records and discovered that she lived near him in Sacramento. His friend drove him to her house, knocked on the door, and asked the woman if she'd given up a baby for adoption in 1986. She said yes, and with tears they fell into one another's arms. My birth mother was hugging me and kissing me and saying that she always remembered me because she named me after her father and brother, Frederick, remembers Matthew. His birth mother, Renee, called his two brothers and they drove over immediately. It was like a movie scene, says Matthew, of the reunion. Renee told Matthew that when one of his brothers was little, he used to go around the house crying, asking where Freddie had gone. Matthew stayed the entire day with his birth family. By the time he got home that night, he finally felt at peace. Since that day, he's reconnected with his extended biological family, including his uncle and aunt, who also live in Sacramento. He now sees them all regularly and recently attended his birth mother's 63rd birthday party. It's been an interesting adventure with my birth mom and her family, says Matthew, who adds that while it hasn't always been easy moving on from the past, he's grateful to have had this opportunity to reconnect. 2 years after meeting him, Matthew's birth father passed away. I remember holding his hand and him crying. He couldn't speak, but whispered, I love you, remembers Matthew. The person Matthew relates to the most is his biological grandfather, a dancer and musician who Matthew never had the chance to meet. Matthew, who took up belly dancing and fire dancing when he was a teenager, believes he inherited his love of dancing from his grandfather. I share the artistic and spiritual qualities that he had. One of his quotes was, no matter how bad things go in life, all you can do is love your children, says Matthew, adding that even through life's darkest lessons, he believes love can conquer all. Our next article is titled, A Definitive Timeline of Dolly Parton and Carl Dean's Enduring Relationship. Though Dolly Parton, 74, is responsible for penning some of the greatest love songs of all time, including the 1973 hit I Will Always Love You, Parton and her husband, Carl Thomas Dean, 78, keep their relationship extremely private. Rarely are the couple, who have been together since 1964, photographed or interviewed together. According to Parton, this has led to the prevalent theory that her husband doesn't actually exist. Spoiler alert, he does. A lot of people have thought that through the years, because he does not want to be in the spotlight at all, Parton told ET in 2020. It's just not who he is. He's like a quiet, reserved person, and he figured if he ever got out there in that, he'd never get a minute's peace, and he's right about that. Yet Dean's privacy may just be the secret that keeps their romance strong. In a 2020 interview with People, Parton gave a rare insight into her married life. After 57 years together, Parton says she and Dean keep the spark alive by planning spontaneous but simple dates for one another. I'll cook the stuff that I know we love, and I pack it up in a picnic basket. And then we'll go find some riverbank somewhere with our little camper, park, and have a picnic. Or we'll pull up to some little days-in motel, go in as long as the bed's clean and there's a bathroom. We just do our little things like that, Parton told People. According to Parton, Dean always thinks of ways to make her feel special. In the springtime, when the first yellow daffodils come out, my husband always brings me a bouquet. And he'll usually write me a little poem. Which to me, that's priceless. That's like a date in itself, Parton told People. Here's a look back at how Dean swept her off her cowboy-booted feet 5 decades ago. Spoiler meet cute alert, it all began at the laundromat. 1964. It was love at first sight for Parton and Dean when they met outside the wishy-washy laundromat in Nashville. She was 18 and he was 21. It was Parton's first day in the Music City, having just moved from her native Sevierville, Tennessee. Parton caught Dean's eye as he drove by in his white pickup truck. Sounds like the makings of a country song, right? My first thought was, I'm going to marry that girl, Dean shared when they renewed their vows at their 50th wedding anniversary celebration in 2016. My second thought was, Lord, she's good looking. And that was the day my life began. While she tended to the fluffing and folding, he reportedly flirted with her. When I met my husband, he wanted to take me out to dinner, Parton told People about their first few years of dating. He pulled up to the drive-in window and got our food at McDonald's. He only likes to go places where he can be comfortable. 1966. On May 30th of that year, Parton and Dean made it official, tying the knot at a church in Ringgold, Georgia. She was 20 and he was 23. The only people in attendance were Parton's mom, Avi Lee, and the preacher and his wife. Back in 1966, Parton had just gotten her big break by singing the demo, Put It Off Until Tomorrow, for country music artist Bill Phillips, and her first solo hit, Dumb Blonde, was gaining momentum on the music charts. Parton and Dean decided to elope because her record label, Monument, was worried that Parton getting hitched would get in the way of her music career. According to People, the record label wanted her to think about it, and Parton, in typical Southern fashion, responded, I ain't waiting. My mother made me a little white dress and a little bouquet, Parton told Country Music Television. But I said, I can't get married in a courthouse because I'll never feel married. So we found a little Baptist church in town, and we went up to Pastor Don Duval and said, would you marry us? We got pictures on the steps right outside the church. Also in 1966. Though Parton was on the fast track to becoming the legendary country music artist she's revered as today, her husband, who runs a local asphalt paving company in Nashville, chose to stay out of the spotlight. Parton recounted a BMI dinner in 1966, which was the first and last industry event she and her husband attended together. Parton was honored with a songwriting award for the Phillips recording of Put It Off Until Tomorrow. But when the night's festivities were over, Dean made it clear that he wanted nothing to do with the entertainment business. This was my first big record, remembered Parton. It went to number one for Bill, and it was BMI's Song of the Year. So Carl and I got dressed up, he was in a tux, and we drove to the dinner. We got out and walked up the red carpet and went inside and sat through dinner and the awards. After the dinner, Carl turned to me and said, Dolly, I want you to have everything you want, and I'm happy for you. But don't you ever ask me to go to another one of these dang things again. However, Parton credits their difference to the success of their 5-decades-long relationship. "They say that opposites attract, and it's true," she told People in 2015. "We're completely opposite, but that's what makes it fun. I never know what he's going to say or do. He's always surprising me." Parton added, "He wants to be mostly around the house. He knows I'm just the opposite. I can't go enough places. I can't do enough things. He loves that. He's independent. He doesn't need me in his face, and it's the same with me. But when we're together, we have enough things in common that it works." 1973. That year, Parton released the hit song Jolene that would 1 year later become the title of her 14th studio album. On the track, Parton sings about confronting a young red-haired woman named Jolene, who she believes is sleeping around with her husband. It's one of her most beloved songs, and along with the success of it came speculation that the lyrics hit a little too close to home. Parton herself fanned the flames of cheating rumors, telling fans at her earlier concerts that she put a stop to Dean spending so much at the bank, where Jolene apparently worked. However, in recent years, Parton has revealed that the real Jolene is actually a little girl, with red hair, green eyes, and fair skin, who she met at one of her shows. When the young woman asked for an autograph and told Parton her name, Parton, according to The Independent, said it was just about the prettiest name she ever heard, and she promised Jolene she would write a song about her. We're not sure which Jolene story is true, but considering the fact that Parton and Dean just celebrated their 52-year wedding anniversary, we're inclined to believe the latter. 2012. Parton dedicated the ode From Here to the Moon and Back to her husband. The song originally appeared on Parton's Joyful Noise soundtrack album to coincide with the musical film of the same name. She later recorded the track as a duet with frequent collaborator Willie Nelson. "I needed to write a beautiful love song," she recalled during an interview with The Boot. "I picked my husband, who I love, and I thought, well, I'll write some beautiful song about him. It was about my husband in the movie, played by Kris Kristofferson, so I thought in order to make it really real and really touching, I would write my real true emotions about someone I really do love and have loved for more than half of my life." 2016. The longtime couple renewed their vows in May 2016, marking their 50th anniversary. Because Parton didn't get the wedding she dreamed of back in 1966, the 9-to-5 singer pulled out all the stops for her intimate renewal ceremony at their home in Nashville. "I got all dressed up in the most beautiful gown you've ever seen and dressed that husband of mine up," Parton told Rolling Stone. "He looked like a handsome dude out of Hollywood. We had a few family and friends around. We didn't plan anything big at all because we didn't want any kind of strain, any kind of tension, any kind of commotion. So we planned it cleverly and carefully. We just had a simple little ceremony at our chapel at our place. We just had fun with it. If I had it all to do over, I'd do it all over again, and we did," Parton said back in 2016. "I'm dragging him kicking and screaming into the next 50 years. Later, in 2016, Dean served as the inspiration for Parton's 46th studio album, Pure and Simple, which was released on August 19th. "I was just trying to think about all the different colors of love through the years," Parton explained during her Rolling Stone interview. "I thought, well, I'm going to write about mine and Carl's relationship. It's just a pure and simple relationship, so it started with that. And then I thought, well, why don't I just write a whole album of love songs?" 2018. The couple doesn't have children, but Parton and Dean enjoy spoiling their nieces and Parton's famous goddaughter, Miley Cyrus. She continues to work with kids through her nonprofit organization, Dolly Parton's Imagination Library, as well. "Now that I'm older, I realize I didn't have kids of my own, so everybody's kids could be mine," Parton told People in November. "I want to empower children and give them confidence." She's also keeping busy these days with music and the confirmed 9-to-5 film reboot. And Parton released the soundtrack for Netflix's original film Dumplin', starring Jennifer Aniston, last year. The album features 6 new songs and 6 reimagined oldies but goodies. Continuing her partnership with the streaming giant, Parton executive produced an 8-part anthology series called Dolly Parton's Heartstrings that's based on her music. Each episode will have a different theme song and cast, and of course, one will include Jolene. 2019. Parton admitted that Dean's not necessarily one of the biggest fans of my music. She told Good Morning Britain host Kate Garraway, "He likes hard rock. He likes Led Zeppelin and bluegrass music, so my music is somewhere in between. He doesn't dislike it, but he doesn't go out of his way to play my records, let's put it that way." Still, Parton said Dean has always supported her in his own way. "He's proud of me," she said, "and he loves that I love what I do. I think it's a touchy subject. I'm like his little girl, I think. He just worries about that." Adding that Dean will show up to her performances at state fairs because he loves to go to the tractor pool. For years and years, he would never come to the shows because he felt like he'd get nervous if I messed up, so he never wanted to watch it, Parton said. The first time he saw me perform and that I was in control of the stage, he was okay. 2020. While on a press tour for her new book, Dolly Parton Songteller, Parton gave an update on her relationship with Dean. Like many couples cooped up together in 2020, Parton lovingly said she and Dean are getting on each other's nerves. "I'm sure he's sick of me," Dolly shared on the Table Manners with Jesse Ware podcast on December 1st. "My husband and I have been together for 57 years, been married 54, and I'm sick of him." But the affection Parton has for her husband remains palpable. Speaking to RuPaul for a Marie Claire profile, Parton revealed that she cooked breakfast for her husband that day. "I made some sausage patties, and I baked some biscuits, and I made some milk gravy. He likes that once in a while. Now, I can't eat like that all the time, but I enjoy eating it when I do," she said, adding that she prepared the meal in high heels, of course. Our next article is titled, 51-year-old surrogate gives birth to her grandchild on behalf of her daughter. A mother's sacrifice knows no bounds. That is the first piece of parenting advice that Julie Loving, a 51-year-old Chicago mother, exemplified when she stepped in to carry her own grandchild after her daughter's 4-year struggle with infertility. And now, new mom Brianna Lockwood knows exactly what that unconditional love feels like with the long-awaited arrival of her daughter. Lockwood shared the news with a photograph welcoming her to the world and revealing her name, Briar Juliet Lockwood. "My mom was an absolute rock star through a difficult delivery. The sacrifices she took to bring this little slice of heaven into our world takes my breath away," Lockwood wrote in the post. "Holding my daughter in my arms, my heart is bursting. The feeling of how I would do absolutely anything needed for this child is radiating through me when I look at her and reflects back on what my mom did for me," she continued. "Every move and decision I make for my daughter, I'm finding the answers through how my mom raised me. The way she loves me and the selflessness she exudes is pure, genuine, and kind." Many loyal commenters who have followed her story shared an outpouring of support and well wishes for Lockwood, her husband Aaron, and her mother Julie during their unique, inspiring story. In July, Brianna Lockwood told OprahMag.com about their unique journey to parenthood. The Lockwoods got hitched in June 2016, and Brianna's grandfather's escalating battle with cancer put a jump start on the couple's plans to have a baby. Lockwood tells OprahMag.com that they wanted to have a baby before his passing, hoping that he would get to meet his great-grandchild. Their attempts to conceive proved to be more difficult than they expected. "I kind of always thought it was going to happen really quickly," Lockwood says. "You spend your whole life preventing, and when you stop preventing, it doesn't happen right away." She adds, "I really struggled with talking about it. It put a strain with family and friends and your marriage. It's something that really rocks someone's world." After months of trying on their own, the couple visited Dr. Brian Kaplan, a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist at Fertility Centers of Illinois, who suggested they begin fertility treatment. Two heartbreaking miscarriages later, Lockwood says she developed Asherman syndrome, which is a condition that is acquired from scarred tissue in the uterus. For Dr. Kaplan, it was time for a new option, but Lockwood was determined. "What really helped me when I was really struggling was that I was very determined. I kept saying, 'I am going to be a mom.' I think that's important for women to know that there are options," Lockwood says. For some couples, determination is one thing, but the cost of surrogacy is another, and the price tag for the Lockwoods was nearly $100,000. To assist with the problem of cost, Loving presented a solution. She'd carry her grandchild for them. She persistently volunteered herself to her daughter, who was reluctant at first, but eventually Loving won her over. "I kind of felt like I went through this with her from the beginning. I felt all of her grief and her struggle. I knew that I was healthy as a 51-year-old, and I knew I could do this for her. I took good care of myself.
I actually don't feel 51. I feel 30, Loving says. When she brought her mother in to visit Dr. Kaplan during an appointment, there was some expected hesitation. I could see a look in his eye, and I could see his wheels beginning to turn a little bit, Lockwood described. Being uniquely fit, Loving passed a series of tests. Cholesterol, psychology, panels of blood work, and more. Miraculously, Loving got the green light from both her daughter and the doctor. This is obviously a very unique scenario and was done after very careful, personalized medical, psychological, and ethical considerations, Dr. Kaplan says. The family dynamic, unconditional support and sacrifice, and the resilience of the human spirit was humbling for me as a physician. Loving, a two-time Boston Marathon runner who pays very close attention to her nutrition, acted as their gestational surrogate, meaning that she carried Brianna and Aaron's biological child and her biological grandchild. Loving says what she provided was simply a testament to a mother's love and sacrifice. No doubt, no regrets, I would do that. I love her so much, I just wanted to help her. Her daughter admits the baby book looks wild right now. Now the family is going public with their remarkable story. During their hardest and darkest days, Lockwood says she was very private. Her experience was painful, and she says sometimes people unintentionally came off as insensitive. But as her journey has transformed into something so extraordinary, Lockwood is sharing every step of their story with her more than 31,000 followers on Instagram. I decided to go public with everything to celebrate my mom and everything she has done, Lockwood says. And although she has struggled with letting her guard down after years of disappointment, she allowed herself to get excited. Her husband, who Lockwood calls the most laid-back, easygoing guy, helps her feel more positive whenever she begins to feel doubtful. He has always believed it's going to work, she says. And while he had been forced to keep some distance during pregnancy appointments because of the coronavirus pandemic, he worked to make sure their baby's nursery was all ready to go. As for Loving, she said she was excited to carry a child again during what she had described as a pretty easygoing pregnancy, though she did admit she felt a bit more fatigued. If you want to continue to follow along on their journey, Lockwood's Instagram account is an open book, in which she shares her personal experiences and resources to raise awareness about infertility treatment, as well as mental health tips. I was shocked by the reception. It was really eye-opening and touching, Lockwood says. And this story, she says, will be one that her daughter will get to know about as soon as she's able to grasp it. And she hints at sharing more news about the delivery. My mom, Julie, and baby Briar are doing fantastic and healthy. I have so much to share on our birth experience, but right now my husband and I are soaking up these newborn moments. Congratulations to the new edition. Our next article, written by Samantha Vicente, is titled Brooke Baldwin on Her New Book and Leaving CNN. On February 16, 2021, Brooke Baldwin opened her weekday CNN broadcast with a special message. After 13 years with the network, she would be leaving in April. Baldwin also revealed the book she'd been working on for the previous 2 years, Huddle, How Women Unlock Their Collective Power. Voicing gratitude for the privilege of helming her own show for a decade, she told viewers, "No, I don't have another job to jump into, and yes, I am feeling very vulnerable." To read Huddle is to witness the 41-year-old anchor realizing that she just forged a new path for herself. Baldwin took the first step when she launched her American Woman series on CNN Digital back in 2017, profiling trailblazers in entertainment and politics. Awed by what the dynamic subjects of her series were doing with, and even more importantly for, their fellow women, Baldwin was moved to uncover similar stories to share. Soon, much of her time outside of work was spent pursuing that curiosity, all the while wondering what had kept her from forming a huddle of her own. Was this a professional decision, a personal passion, both? I didn't know exactly, Baldwin writes in Huddle's prologue. But as a career journalist, I felt compelled to follow my gut and see where that aching question might lead me. In the book, Baldwin defines a huddle as a moment that brings women together in any time or place, whether on the front lines of a public protest or in a quiet church basement, to provide each other with support, empowerment, inspiration, and the strength to solve problems or enact meaningful change.
The huddles the journalist profiles in the book are varied, as befits a country with 166 million women living in it. An early chapter spotlights the 19 black judicial candidates of Harris County, Texas, who formed a network and successfully convinced the Democratic Party that they'd be stronger campaigning together. It worked, 17-1, a history-making election. Another takes us into the writing room for Reese Witherspoon's Little Fires Everywhere, where a diversity of voices leads to more authentic stories about women. We meet military wives, West Virginia teachers, teenage climate change activists, and professional athletes who've pooled their time and resources to connect and affect change. Interspersed are thoughts from mold-breaking huddlers like Stacey Abrams and Gloria Steinem, and chapters that find Baldwin sharing personal stories from her own life. Placing herself in the narrative was not what I'm used to, Baldwin tells Oprah Daily. Unlike my day job, that line between interviewer and interviewee would start to blur, and they'd start to ask me about my passion, my huddle, and my career, she continues. Opening up caused a bigger inner shift than she'd anticipated. It's actually the reason why, in the end, I have to do this backflip off the high dive and leave CNN to do some other stuff. I can't just stand in these women's spaces and not try to be half as brave as they are. Baldwin also felt that readers deserve to know that before the book, she'd been huddleless for most of her adult life, having moved around so much while she focused on her job. I believe women are each other's best resource, but I needed to take a bit of my own medicine, she admits. Since rallying a mix of old friends who live across the U.S., Baldwin can now attest firsthand to what those who appear in Huddle taught her. When women set an intention to support, amplify, and invest their valuable time in each other, the returns are exponential for everyone. Writers Anne Friedman and Amana Tausu, best friend collaborators who appear in Huddle, call it shine theory, the idea that I don't shine if you don't shine. It's given me life and helped me get through COVID, Baldwin says of the huddle she didn't have until she was 38. I never want to go back. Brimming with hopeful stories from all over the country, Huddle isn't starry-eyed about the fact that women haven't always been each other's cheerleaders, and historically, we've rarely been encouraged to be. A chapter titled From Scarcity to Abundance in a Man's World spotlights the need to break free of the scarcity dynamic that American women have been socialized to believe in. That is, the false premise that there's a limited number of seats at the table for those who aren't men, and throwing elbows towards the competition is the most effective way to snag one. In it, women who work in male-dominated fields, including director Ava DuVernay and Michelin star chef Dominique Crenn, share the ways they've tried to spread the wealth instead by creating more space for the women who come after them. Alongside many of the voices in Huddle, Baldwin stresses that being stronger together means pushing yourself to reach out across race, class, and traditional gender lines. In the prologue, where Baldwin tells Oprah Daily she was very intentional about checking my own privilege, she writes that this book is for all women who want to join. All women, psi, trans, and non-binary. As a political science professor points out in Huddle, American women's collective action movement stalled out in the 80s and 90s after white women, in particular, reaped the biggest benefits from hard-won legal equality wins. Upon gaining access to new opportunities, the overwhelming majority forgot to help those who faced additional discrimination move up the ladder, too. Baldwin says her inclusive lens throughout was also informed by what the Georgia native has learned during this time of racial reckoning, and also from having friends who don't all look like me. Sarah Harden, the CEO of Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine, told me, "If we just replace the patriarchy with a bunch of white women in those seats at the table, we've changed nothing." That really hit me in my heart, Baldwin says. It's just about giving more women a shot and figuring out how to do this across the board. As of February 2021, layoffs, furloughs, and a childcare crisis have disproportionately affected American women more than men, with 3 million leaving the workforce since early 2020. Isolation, plus additional stressors caused by the pandemic, have left friendships and just about every other community and professional connection imaginable neglected as many struggle to stay afloat daily. Noting that nurturing a huddle can be as time minimal as a quick weekly check-in or a group text chain, Baldwin points again to the benefits of forming a supportive circle of women. In other words, even if you think you don't need one, you might be surprised to discover that you really do. The pandemic has helped me realize that I've never needed connection more than now, Baldwin says. When we get out of this, I can't wait to see how we all connect in real life, in a way we just took for granted before, she adds. We're not there yet, but we're on the precipice. Speaking of looking ahead to the future, what's next for Brooke Baldwin? And did she know that writing Huddle would ignite a decision to leave CNN? It was definitely something that was in my mind. I just didn't know when it would happen, Baldwin says. Though she said she didn't have a new gig to unveil at the time of our talk in March, she's extremely game for trying new things, such as her guest hosting stint on Ellen. I'd love to create a docuseries for a streaming network, she muses. Regardless of platform, Baldwin wants to dive deep into storytelling and continue the mission she started with the book. I want to bring this message to women whenever we can physically be in rooms together, Baldwin says. I'm sure the waterworks on my last day will be at 1,000%, but I just feel compelled to dive into something bigger than myself. To end our show, Oprah opens up about getting the COVID-19 vaccine. Stedman and I were blessed enough to be able to create our own bubble at home during the pandemic. As soon as lockdown began, two of our grown daughter girls from South Africa quarantined with us and worked from home virtually. Two members of our staff stayed within the bubble, and anyone who wanted to come from outside had to be quarantined in our guest house for 14 days. The first shot, I wanted to cry, but didn't, just from the overwhelming sense of relief. I'd had pneumonia the previous year, and my lungs were still sensitive. I was very much afraid of the toll COVID-19 would take on me. It's why I was so super strict about the goings and comings of everyone in my space. After the second vaccination shot, I didn't feel well for about 30 hours. But afterwards, I felt like Superwoman, like I'd been given a new lease on life. But it hasn't changed my habits. For now, I'm just grateful beyond description to have the vaccine. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.